Welcome to Getting Through It, where we're here to help you get through it. I'm John Pueri, and as always, I'm joined with scientist Dr. Lucy Jones. Thanks to all the listeners who stepped up to sponsor this podcast. You can too by joining as a sponsor of Dr. Lucy Jones's Center for Science and Society, a nonprofit working to bring science to communities across the country. Please go to patreon.com and be a sponsor too. That's patreon.com and search Dr. Lucy Jones. Now let's get to it. With wildfires burning across California and with hundreds of faults crisscrossing the state, it's inevitable that the fires will pass over some of them, including the San Andreas Fault. Knowing that earthquakes happen well below the surface and wildfires don't impact much more than the upper levels of the topsoil, how are faults related to wildfires?
Faults really are not related to wildfires. Fire is happening on the Earth's surface, and it can't affect the area where the earthquakes could actually be triggered. So there's no way that a fire is going to set off an earthquake. And the fault is not affecting the fire. I mean, it doesn't have an ignition source. And it really isn't putting out gases. You know, we do measure things along the fault, so we know what comes out of them. And it's, you know, we aren't seeing methane coming out of the fault. So it just doesn't matter as long as you don't have an earthquake. Now, the one place where this is different is that when you do have an earthquake, you do create ignition sources. There are metal things that run into each other. We break things like, you know, gas pipes. And so when we have earthquakes, we always see fires. If we put the earthquakes in a city, we get a lot more fires because we have a lot of things to break there. But, you know, when we have them up through the wildland areas, especially if we have dry, windy weather, we can get wildfires going. And, of course, then we don't have the resources to fight them because people, the firemen, are down trying to save people in the city. And we think one of the consequences of a big San Andreas earthquake will be not just urban fires, but fires in the wildland as well.
I mean, this really goes back to your work that you've been doing for decades, where you've explained not just what the Earth does in a disaster, but what the impact will be on our communities, on society. How do scientists come to understand both the interaction of the hazards, you know, the relationship between faults and fires or wildfires and earthquakes, and the impacts they have on humans?
Well, that's sort of the definition of interdisciplinary work. And, you know, science is a process by which you take things apart and isolate factors and try to see whether X is true because you've been able to prove that nothing else impacts it. So we tend to get very down into the weeds. To turn it into impact for people, you need to come back up, and we need to integrate across disciplines. And actually, the scientists will sometimes argue about it because it's like, I don't know what this particular earthquake will do because there's too many variables. And it's like, yeah, that's true, but we can get a plausible picture. And those plausible pictures we call scenarios. And because they're just plausible, not just proofs, you've got to do a lot of them. And when we do a lot, you know, we start seeing things that show up over and over. For instance, urban fires, landslides in mountainous areas, those show up over and over. And we're able to be quite confident once we've done a lot of scenarios that this is really what's going to happen. And there's a really big important part about science. One study doesn't give you an answer. It needs to be repeated over and over. And that process of eliminating all the possibilities takes time. The answer that's really usable only shows up when we've gotten through that process and, in fact, when the scientists have gotten bored with it.
When scientists have gotten bored, the rest of us benefit because we can use that outcome to make better decisions in our life and in our communities.
If we can get to them. And there's one of sort of our holes in American society. We fund the scientists to get the answer. And they're like, I'm an academic. My job is to publish papers. I'm done with this. It's somebody else's job. And we haven't really filled that space of how to take science information that maybe isn't all that accessible to a policymaker over to the policymakers in a way that they can understand. Of course, that's what we've been trying to do, is bridge that gap, because it is a pretty big gap in our society.
And I think that's probably what brings up the idea that whenever we see a disaster, whether it's a hurricane or a wildfire like we're seeing across California and the West right now, that you go to social media or you go just to news reports and there's ideas and theories that people are putting forward that they think that policymakers or firefighters or land managers or even the scientists should be looking at or using to address the crisis in front of them. During a wildfire, you hear everything from prescribed burns to seeding clouds for rain. You know, and there's all sorts of suggestions that surface during this time. And it's these ideas that come out because people who are trying to find a way to make themselves feel better, to explain away what seems out of control in the disaster, what seems unexplainable. When we hear of a study in the moment in a disaster, how do we find its validity, especially when there's all this noise of the disaster?
I think you need to not get too focused on an individual study. Science is a process of digging into the weeds to the point that you isolate your one weed away from everybody else and be able to say, this weed is here for this particular reason. And you can only be sure of it when you've eliminated all the other possibilities. So we spend a lot of time breaking things apart and getting it down to the smallest possible unit so we can test it. But that's not how you go about making policy. You need to be saying there's this factor and that factor and this other factor and these policy considerations and this funding consideration. And you need to really have a web of information that helps you be able to determine what's the best policy that trades off between these different things. So you need to not focus on an individual study. You need to look at the bigger picture. And, you know, understanding when something's really true really does need that bigger picture. This all reminds me of a time decades ago when a famous planetary scientist studying methane on the gas planets decided that what he was seeing there applied to the earthquake problem. And he was going to predict earthquakes because he's decided that earthquakes were caused by methane explosions. He saw this process elsewhere. He is going to be able to use it. And the thing is, there was a whole field of seismology that he didn't look at. It wasn't called earthquake prediction. It was called discrimination seismology, how we discriminate between a bomb and an earthquake, that showed really, really conclusively that earthquakes were not explosions. We could tell the difference between bombs and earthquakes because they weren't explosions. And this guy, a famous scientist, made a real fool of himself coming in because he didn't look at that bigger web. So it's not like scientists don't make the same problems, but all of us need to consider the larger picture. I mean, you know, seeding clouds might be a good idea, but what's the other impact of it? And you really better have a wide understanding of meteorology before you go in and try and do that.
And the work you've done and that I've done with you as we work with policymakers reminds us that that web of information can be very complex, and sometimes it's about distilling it down to what is needed in the moment to make the right decision in front of us with the authority of scientific expertise at our back, ready to be presented if requested, but be able to give that answer of what might happen, the impacts of the choices being made.
Yeah, and to be able to use that knowledge of that larger web to go, yeah, that sounds an interesting idea, but here's the other factors. It's that wide range of knowledge that the expert brings in that helps not to make the decision, but to make sure that the decision maker understands the implications of his decisions by seeing it in that bigger picture.
So if we go back to the disaster at hand, someone's feeling like they need an answer and they recognize and admit, okay, science is a process. What does it give us in the moment as we wait for the process that you've just described to play out?
The last study doesn't give you an answer, and probably none of it gives you the black and white answer that you want. You know, when we're faced with disasters, we go, I want to know how to be safe. If I stay 6 feet away, I'm going to be safe from COVID. Well, no, staying 6 feet away reduces your risk from COVID. Wearing a mask reduces your risk. None of it makes it perfectly safe. And I think about the last 6 months, how we, you don't bother with masks because they don't keep you safe. We asked the wrong question. We didn't say, by saying, will they keep you safe? The answer is, well, no. But if you asked, will it make society safer? The answer is absolutely yes. So we need to understand that we don't get absolute yes or no answers in most situations. We're finding ways to make life better, not like make life perfect.
So we know that science is a process. We know that we have to do many studies in order to get an answer that gives us more clarity of what is actually going on in the world around us. And we know, based on what you just said, that science doesn't make us safe. It makes us safer than we would have been without it. It doesn't completely eliminate risk. It helps reduce the risk to make it livable, to make us survivable for what we might face. So when in the middle of a disaster or crisis, what could our listeners do, you know, to find the insights to control the chaos? What can they do to put some order or explanation around the experience they're having in a crisis?
A tweet that compares X and Y is not a scientific study. The right answers take time, multiple studies, lots of examination, and work after the studies to go back and integrate all of the different information with policy requirements. So, you know, if you want to go following the most recent science, great. But you need to remember that it's not a black and white answer. You need to dig beyond the news and see what other studies are relevant. If you want to use the most recent, take the time. That's obviously not what current society and social media try to get us to, but that's what you need to do to be able to get it right. Or wait for the answer. You know, at time, we will get there. And when the multiple studies, when it stops being exciting news, that's when we've actually got information that we can use.
So don't share the headline. It might be slightly misleading.
Ah, could very well be misleading. Headline writers are also different from the story writers, and sometimes they come up with really interesting twists.
Well, we could go on forever on this, so we'll have to do it again. Until next time, I'm John Boeri with Dr. Lucy Jones and you, Getting Through It. Getting Through It is a production of the Dr. Lucy Jones Center for Science and Society. Visit us online to get past shows and become a sponsor at patreon.com. That's patreon.com and search Dr. Lucy Jones. There you can get extras, insights, and access to the entire world of Getting Through It. Our music is performed by Josh Lee, and this closing music is written by our own Dr. Lucy Jones.